haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people at around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Shir Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan. But that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Guadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Hara trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Khore Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a khore or firth. It's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Khore Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Guadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads, not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilay. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hutags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, Countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good, simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Shir Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bakhsh is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people, traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shah Bakhsh. When I ask him if he has ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment. A place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I too am proud of these honest, kind people. Proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.
Well, perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide, but I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Balochistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16th, 2021. Some advice to those responsible for conducting the elections. Making the necessary preparations to ensure the voters' health. I have almost finished talking about the elections. I just want to give some advice to those responsible for conducting the elections. May God give them strength that they must make the necessary preparations and predictions to ensure people's health when they go to the ballot boxes, because people want to participate in the elections. This participation and going to the ballot boxes must not bring any harm to the health of the society, and this requires certain preparations. Of course, the authorities have announced that they are working on this. I also emphasize that they must definitely work on this. Secondly, they have reported to me that one of the problems we have, which we have faced repeatedly in elections and about which there have always been complaints, is that sometimes in an election center, they say there are no ballot papers left. Or suppose the elections start at 7 or 8, there are no ballot papers in some centers yet for the people to vote. They must solve this problem. They should ensure that there are no centers without ballot papers. The ballot papers are made available without delay and that there is no shortage of ballot papers. This was the second point for which the necessary preparations needed to be made. Thirdly, in reports from abroad, they have reported to me that in some of these countries, perhaps in a large number of countries, not all necessary preparations have been made in foreign countries. I asked the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Interior Affairs to make serious efforts to correct this matter, and since there is not much time left to help the Iranians who wish to participate in the elections in foreign countries to be able to do so. This was the next point. Fourthly, they must deal with any violations. This is what I wanted to say. I ask God the Almighty to guide our hearts. O God, the hearts belong to you and are under your control. Guide all the hearts toward what is good for this country and this nation. May God's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. continues to service Saudi warplanes through private contractors. Without maintenance, the Royal Saudi Air Force would be grounded. That would save thousands of lives. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Aisha Joman and Charles Pearson, writers. This article is published under the heading, Biden Turns His Back on Yemen. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. In his first major foreign policy address on February 4th, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that he was ending all support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. 5 months later, U.S. assistance to the Saudi-led coalition attacking Yemen continues, even though some observers don't realize it. In an otherwise perceptive article on President Biden's foreign policy in May 27, 2021, New York Review of Books, Jessica T. Matthews writes that President Biden withdrew American support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen that has produced little more than an atrocious level of human suffering. Only the second half of this sentence is true. 233,000 Yemenis have died over the course of war, which entered its seventh year in March. The country is on the brink of famine, with 24 million Yemenis relying on humanitarian aid to survive. Over 2 million children are acutely malnourished, with a child dying every 75 seconds. The American Public Health Association Governing Council has twice passed policy statements condemning the U.S.-supported blockade of Yemen, most recently in 2020, a call to end the bombing of Yemen and the blockade on its ports. Small wonder the UN has declared Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and eight other Persian Gulf and Arab nations attacked Yemen in March 2015, after the pro-Saudi government of President Rabo Mansour Hadi overthrew. Since then, Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations have provided the coalition with intelligence, targeting assistance, spare parts for coalition aircraft, arms sales, and until November 2018, in-flight refueling of coalition warplanes. Yemenis speak of the Saudi-American war. The Saudis continue to bomb Yemen despite their June 10th announcement that they were suspending airstrikes. The U.S. continues to service Saudi warplanes through private contractors. Without maintenance, the Saudi Royal Air Force would be grounded. That would save thousands of lives. A staggering 23,000 Saudi UAE air raids have struck Yemen since 2015. On August 9, 2018, airstrike on a school bus killed 40 children. One Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives wrote President Biden in February calling attention to the coalition's unconscionable record of indiscriminately bombing tens of thousands of civilians and destroying civilian infrastructure, including hospitals, schools, refugee camps, sewage treatment plants, and markets. Food, fuel, and medicine have become unaffordable, owing to a coalition land, sea, and air blockade. The Saudis severely restricted entry of fuel tankers into the port of Hodeidah for the first 4 months of 2021. Yet the Biden administration did not even acknowledge the existence of the blockade until an expose in March by CNN senior correspondent Nima El Bagher. Yemen's desperate people, however, are running out of time. Each day, the blockade remains in place, brings Yemen closer to famine. The blockade must be lifted now, with or without a ceasefire. The Saudi coalition cannot be allowed to use starvation as leverage over Yemenis. Biden could have issued an executive order on his first day in office ending U.S. support for the Saudi coalition. Biden's failure to do so means that Congress must act. In 2019, in a historic move, Congress passed the War Powers Resolution, which would have ended all U.S. assistance to the Saudi coalition. President Trump vetoed the resolution. Congress must pass a new War Powers Resolution, this time by veto-proof majorities in the House and Senate. While he is a welcome change from the incompetence, venality, and cruelty of the Trump administration, Biden has continued the Obama and Trump's administration's support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Commentators like Jessica T. Matthews give Biden credit he does not yet deserve. We should hold applause until Biden actually ends U.S. support for Yemen's destruction. The Spotlight.
Hello, and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, imagine a terrorist group which has been operating for decades, killing tens of thousands of people of various nationalities. Iranians, Iraqis, Americans, and others have all fallen victim to the Mujahideen Khalq organization, the MKO, also known as the MEK. Now, the organization has targeted at least 17,000 Iranians and is currently holding its annual meeting, this time online. Despite its horrible human rights record, the organization is no longer listed as a terrorist group by the U.S. and the EU. Its meetings are held in Paris, and some Western politicians will once again participate in the meeting. The question is why? Stay with us as we take a look at one of the world's most notorious groups, the Mujahideen Khalq organization, on the Spotlight.
The Mujahideen Khalq organization was founded in the 1960s. The group started the blind assassination campaign of Iranian citizens and officials after the 1979 Islamic Revolution in a bid to overturn the Islamic establishment and control the country. They also conducted dozens of bombings across Iran. Out of nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the group's acts of terror. Former Iranian President Mohammad Ali Rajoi and ex-Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Bahonar are among those killed in the MKO terror attacks. The group is also responsible for a massive blast targeting the headquarters of the Islamic Republic Party on June 28, 1981 in Tehran. At least 72 senior Iranian officials and lawmakers, including then Judiciary Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Ali Beheshti, lost their lives in the bombing. The MKO is also behind the failed assassination attempt on the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in 1981. During a war launched against Iran by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, MKO members were armed by then the Iraqi regime and prepared them to fight alongside Baathist forces against the Islamic Republic. Despite all crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the US, that often claim to be against any form of terrorism, rather removed the MKO from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012 respectively. Ever since, the West has changed its stance toward the MKO, propagating it not only as an Iranian opposition group, but misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor. The MKO throws lavish conferences every year in the French capital, Paris, with well-known American, Western, and Saudi figures in attendance as guests of honor. Some of these figures who attend these events include former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former Mayor of New York City Rudy Giuliani, former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and former Saudi spy chief Prince Turki bin Faisal Al Saud. The MKO is currently based in Albania, where it enjoys freedom of activities despite being involved in taking thousands of innocent Iranian lives and plotting terrorist attacks for decades.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the Spotlight, activist and former MKO member Ebrahim Khodabandi out of Tehran, and expert in cultic abuse and radicalization, and Khodabandi out of Leeds. Thank you both for being with us. Well, I'd like to start this off with, and tell me, because from what I understand, you've had a personal experience in dealing with this group. I want to start off right there and give us a little background in your relationship in dealing with this group and what you found.
Hello, thank you for inviting me on the program.
Thank you for coming.
Yes, when I was a student back in 1978-79 at Manchester University, I came across a group of Iranians who were very active in activities related to the revolution at that time. And being a young person, quite interested in politics and world affairs, I kind of got to know them and got sort of close to some of them. And from there, it's led to more and more involvement as a student, going to demonstrations in London, getting involved in sort of publicity activities. And little by little, I was drawn into the kind of atmosphere that they had created, to the point that in 1989, I actually gave up my job. I was a computer programmer, at that time, well-paid job, I had a home, I had a car, and I gave that all up and became a full-time activist with the Mujahideen. That lasted for 3 years before I finally had enough, if you like, but it still took me another 3 years before I could actually separate from them and leave fully. So around about 96, maybe, I kind of washed my hands of the organisation. But from that point on, I really began to question the experiences I'd been through. And talking to other ex-members, it became very clear that this was no ordinary group and that it operated as a cult, and it used cultic abuse to control its members. And so from there, I did a lot of research, began to talk to people, experts in radicalization and so on and so forth, and began to campaign really against the group in order to try to help other members who, like myself, had been trapped and had no way of understanding what kind of situation they were in until they left.
Let me just jump in here. I want to understand it. So you were trapped in that group. You had been brainwashed, but at the time you didn't even realize it. Is that true?
That is absolutely true. Absolutely true. In fact, it was a question I raised with some of the more senior members. I said, "Are we a cult?" And they basically laughed at me and said, "Well, no, but it doesn't matter. You know, it's just people trying to demonize the Mujahideen and trying to stop us from doing what we're doing, and sort of put obstacles in the way of our struggle." And of course, I was so brainwashed at that time that I was quite happy to, accept that explanation.
Okay. Well, stay with me, and I'm going to come back to you, but want to get Ibrahim in on this conversation. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Your experience, because you were a member. Tell me a little bit about your experience so our viewers understand who you are.
Thank you very much. I left Iran in 1971 to study in Britain. I was 18 then. And in 1981, I joined the organization. I became a full-time member, and mainly I was working in international department of the organization. I traveled to more than 20 countries and did diplomatic missions for the organization.
So you were a high-ranking member.
I was one of the officials of the international relations, actually. And in 2003, I left the organization, came back to Iran, and since then I've been active to try to reveal the true nature of this organization.
Okay, stop right there, because I want to understand. So what happened to make you want to leave the organization?
I realized that whatever they say, it's they lie to everybody. They trained us to lie to everybody, and we used to attract people to the way they wanted to be attracted, and gain the support of the parliamentarians, others, and we used to study about them. And I realized that I was brainwashed. And I joined the organization because I thought they are Islamic and they are anti-imperialist and they are socialist. But I realized that they are everything but these things that they claim. So I decided to try to tell everybody that also they claimed a lot of lies. They started their terrorist activities against Iran exactly 40 years ago, 1981. And in the first 10 years, they claimed 12,000 lives according to their own documents. And some people claimed 17,000. Also, they moved to Iraq and joined the Iranians' enemy against Iranians. And all the people that they killed inside Iran were ordinary people. They had nothing to do with the government or politics. And even they abused the very rights of their own people.
So let me just stop you one more time. So how does an individual, Iranian, as you said, who thought that they were joining an Islamic group and fighting for the people, then get to the point that they can kill regular people? I think this part is difficult for people to understand.
This is the nature of cults, as Mrs. Khodabandi just pointed out. that they attract people and recruit people with any excuse, and then the mind manipulation and the psychologic methodology works and keeps the people, and they make them to do things against their own wish.
Okay, okay. Well, turning back to Leeds now, and I want to talk about this organization, and even though it has killed so many people, we look at these Western capitals that at one point in time, this organization was listed as a terrorist organization, for example, by the United States, by the EU, and then now is no longer listed. What do you make of that? What does that mean when it's still responsible for the killing of at least 17,000 human beings?
Sure, it is a strange phenomenon, isn't it, that a group which is so, I mean, the beginning of the program, there was a whole catalogue of the crimes and abuses that the Mujahideen have committed over the years, and yet Western politicians and media appear to turn a blind eye to that. There's several reasons. One is, as Ebrahim Khodavandi, my brother-in-law, I have to say, is pointing out, the Mujahideen are essentially deceptive, and so they will present themselves in a very, very different way to what they really are. They develop what you might call a radicalized persona, which is actually quite attractive. You've heard the expression magnetic personality. People who are radicalized do develop a superficial personality, which is actually very attractive to people. And so when they go into meetings with politicians and such like, they can sort of switch on this very charming and very convincing persona. And it is actually, unless you understand what's happening, it's quite difficult to resist it in many ways. Now, the second sort of point that the Mujahideen have is that, yes, there are many, many what you might call anti-Iran people, groups, politicians, governments, and so there's rich pickings really for finding support. And so therefore, if you go to the neocons in America, for example, or Israel, you'll find lots and lots of people who are very, very much against Iran, and they will look for any sort of tool and any opportunity to harm Iran, to create propaganda, misleading information, and to sort of basically find a way to sort of propagandize against the country. Mm-hmm. And Mujahideen, from the very beginning, set themselves up in that role. So not only were they involved in terrorism, when they were based in Iraq, they were very, very close to Iran, and they had a military presence. And so they could fulfill both those functions. However, since 2003, they've shifted their focus. They were disarmed by the US Army in 2003, and their focus is mostly now propaganda and intelligence work, okay, which they are involved with.
Ebrahim, let's talk about their funding. I mean, where does the organization get its money from?
This is one of the things that they never let us to ask them. But my brother, Masoud Khodavandi, had experience of going to Saudi Arabia, like Masoud Rajavi. He was invited by Amir Abdullah and Turki Faisal, who was the head of security system of Saudi. Mm-hmm. And he said that the amount of gold that they were given to could not be carried out by aeroplane, and they had to hire a lot of lorries to bring them to Iraq. And the organization has a lot of cover charity organizations, and they don't actually work as charity. They work for money laundry, and the help that comes from Saudi Arabia or from United States goes into these organizations and becomes like charity, and then goes to the organization, and it shows if the people are helping the organization. But they are wealthy organization. They get a lot of fund, and they well spent the money.
Why would, the question I asked at the beginning of the show, why would these American politicians, or Western politicians, we've seen so many of them, some very high-ranking individuals, especially during the Trump administration and others, why would they support this terrorist organization that's also responsible for the murder of Americans?
And the thing is, the reality is that with the Islamic Revolution in Iran, U.S. lost a lot of interests, and they are always after gaining this interest back. I remember I was 25 when the revolution occurred, and everybody knew that the power of U.S. ambassador in Tehran was more than Shah, who was the absolute monarch. And unfortunately, the U.S. officials don't have the understanding that time has changed, and they can't have this, the like of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in Iran again. And the way that they support MEK shows that how the empty-handed they are against Iran, because this is the organization that is very much hated by the Iranians. I've been living in Iran for 18 years now. I've been communicating with the people, and I have not seen anybody being hated so much by the people, because they say that they have been working with the enemy, they have killed innocent people, and they encourage U.S. to impose sanctions against Iran, all these things. So it shows how Americans are empty-handed. And it's not a good policy at all. But the time has come that they realize that Iran is a new Iran, and they should deal with the new Iran.
Okay, stay with me. Let me cross back over to Leeds. And I want to look at, because I was reading some of things you had written, and dealing with now this group is basically based in Albania, and that they are also trying to influence young people there. I want to talk about this toxic element of this organization, no matter where they are. And why would the Albanian government, or actually the Europeans, allow this base now in that country?
Yeah, I just want to just carry on from what Ibrahim was saying there, that we must make it clear that governments don't support the Mujahideen. It is they are paid politicians who come to the conferences and ex-officials and such like. It isn't that the Mujahideen actually have the support of other governments. They are a useful tool for them. None of these governments, US, UK, European governments, they don't see the Mujahideen as a viable alternative, even though that's what the Rajabis would like you to see them as. So I just wanted to make it clear that since Mujahideen lost the support of Saddam Hussein, the only government which has actually offered them support is the Albanian government, and they give direct support to them. And that is essentially why the Mujahideen are based there, because they have actually been literally pushed out of every other North America, Europe, Britain. They've been pushed out. In Albania, as you're suggesting, they are sort of reduced in number, and their sort of focus when they arrived there was to try to recruit some new people, local people, because obviously they didn't speak Albanian, they didn't know anything about the country, and in order to somehow embed themselves into that country, they began to they put on a recruitment drive, which is essentially how they recruited people like myself. And so, yes, they started to target young Albanian people, getting them, sort of convincing them that they had this noble struggle against this demonic Iranian regime that was killing and harming people. And I think the Albanian media sort of picked up on this, and they were really shocked, and 'cause they'd been told that the Mujahideen were there on humanitarian reasons, and they were sort of all prepared to go help them. And then suddenly this organization is trying to recruit people for regime change. And it was really essentially a shock to the system. Unfortunately for Albania, the Mujahideen are highly sophisticated in their methods of corruption and deception. And of course, Albania, being a country which is more or less ruled by America, America is not entirely independent in that sense. So the Americans gave the nod to the government to continue supporting the Mujahideen and not to stand in their way.
Okay, sorry to interrupt you, but we're so limited in time. Ibrahim, looking at this, I mean, and said basically that these countries really don't support them in a sense. But, I mean, we look at, for example, this annual meeting is held once again in Paris, although it is online this year, and we see how they have been delisted by the EU and by the United States. So at this point in time, when we see that these Western governments supporting an entity, a terrorist entity, like the MKO, like the MEK, is it far-fetched to imagine, because a lot of, you know, there are lots of accusations about Western support for other terrorist organizations like Daesh, like al-Nusra Front. So when you don't make that line black and white, that you are really against terrorism, does that mean that they are actually supporters of terrorism? Or how do you see these Western governments? And basically, at the very least, we can say looking the other way with what the MEK and MKO is doing, and at best even supporting them and helping them with their activities.
Well, I think that the Western governments don't mind to use terrorists as tools against or for their own benefits. That's what's happening with the MEK. And they very well know that how much they are hated by the Iranians. That's why they don't get too close to them. I mean, they never support them in state level. But on the other hand, they try to use them as much as they can against Iran. And I should say that as far as I've seen here, MEK is no longer a security threat or even a social threat or a political threat for Iran. It could bother Iran sometime in some cases, but not a threat.
Okay.
But as far as I'm concerned,
30 seconds, sorry.
They are a human rights case because they have trapped some 2,000 members in Albania that brainwashed them. They are living in modern slavery, and the families are suffering very much because they have no contact with them. This is the case that matters at the moment for us. And I think that the Western countries should revise their policy, because this policy didn't get anywhere in the past 40 years, and it won't get anywhere again.
Okay, hopefully these so-called human rights organizations are listening to what you had to say. I want to thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Activist and former MK member Ibrahim Khodobandi here in Tehran with me, and expert in cultic abuse and radicalization, and Khodobandi out of Leeds. And again, as you said, that is he is your brother-in-law, so you are family, and I appreciate both.